if you keep a very competitive nature with each other from a friendly perspective and pressure to be the best, then you're going to perform and try your hardest.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of our podcast, Partners in Time, the podcast where we meet people in and around the IWC brand and the world of IWC and the things that obviously make us tick. And there are a few things that make us a tick more than pilots' watches. And of course, within that, the year of the pilot, it's clearly a big focus on Top Gun, especially this fall and this autumn. So I'm very, very honored to welcome our guest for today. It is retired US Navy Captain Jim DiMatteo, an actual Top Gun instructor and somebody with more than 5,000 flying hours under their belt. As iconic an aircraft as the F-5s and the Tomcats, of course, and all the things in between. And I think he's going to be able to give us a fantastic insight into the life and world of a modern fast jet pilot, and especially the ins and outs of the Top Gun program, originally at Naval Air Station Miramar, nowadays at Naval Air Station Fallon in Nevada. And I just want to highlight before I say hello that, of course, Jim today is talking to us in a personal capacity, that just for our listeners to have the background. But Jim, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Well, hello, Chris. I'm doing great. Thank you very much for inviting me on this podcast. I'm excited to talk to you about this stuff. How are you doing?
I'm good. I am not in sunny Nevada. I think it's probably quite hot and dry where you are, I suppose, at the moment. Huh? We're hearing scary heat wave stories. It's like 106 degrees or something. Huh?
Yesterday when I took off, and it's interesting because we start to get at a point where we don't take off our fighter jets at a certain temperature. But yes, it was well over 100 degrees yesterday here. So
wow.
It's warm.
Wow. So you can't take off in a fighter jet at a certain temperature. Is that because the undercarriage tires are melting or because the engine will just totally blow?
No, it's just it depends. High, hot air density, single engine takeoff capabilities, tires, tire speed, true air speed, lots of different kind of factors play into the whole thing, what your weight is, what your centerline tanks, et cetera. So lots of different factors play into it, but we tend to have just like a number. We put it at like 105 degrees we do for a safety measure. And we were close to that yesterday. So
yeah,
it is warm here. Yes.
So what are you flying at the moment, day-to-day basis?
Right now, I'm with Tactical Air Support, so retired from the active duty Navy, and our company is essentially like a contracted adversary, a Top Gun adversary for hire, if you will, a company that there's a new concept in both the Air Force and the Navy in the United States to outsource the bad guy role, the adversary role. For many reasons, it makes sense, not only from a financial perspective. Industry can somehow do this cheaper than the government and the military can, but also it preserves your most cherished assets, both the aircraft and the pilots themselves, to concentrate on the blue side, on the, if you will, their role, and they don't have to pretend to be the bad guy. And so there's this new wave of doing this, and Tactical Air Support is one of a couple companies on the planet that do this, and so that's why I'm flying the F-5 in the Top Gun adversary role right now.
So you are flying the F-5. See, and I always think that is quite unique as a connection to where we are in Switzerland, where I can positively confirm that summer has not arrived. I think it's low 60s here. It is absolutely pouring it down every single day and has done so for 6-7 weeks. We're right here on the banks of the River Rhine, and the River Rhine is about half a meter away from actually completely flooding the riverbanks. So it's quite an interesting summer. But what is unique about Switzerland, and I'm not sure if many of our listeners are aware of that, is we basically, our Air Force in Switzerland flies the US Navy hardware, in the sense that we have FA-18 Legacy Hornets as the main fighter type in Switzerland. That fighter is actually in the US Navy configuration, including the tailhook, which is very interesting because, of course, we are completely landlocked and these aircraft have definitely never seen a carrier in their lives. But theoretically, I think they've got most of the equipment on to be landing on the Gerald R. Ford or anything else. And of course, we also fly or used to fly and still fly the F-5s in active duty. I think not anymore in the Air Force, but definitely with the equivalent of the Blue Angels, which is in Switzerland, the Patrouille Suisse flying the F-5. And obviously Switzerland having a huge legacy in F-5 fighter squadrons as well. So quite an interesting mirror image of the US Navy at the other end of the world in very mountainous territory, but at least the same aircraft type.
Even a more interesting connection than that, not more, but an additional interesting connection is when Switzerland started to upgrade to the Hornet and now, I guess, the F-35, they will sell their aircraft back to the United States.
Yeah, for more than new, probably.
who knows how who negotiates those business transactions?
The Swiss are clever with money, but Jim, you know.
I'm sure. I don't think the U.S. was on the winning side, I was part of a deal where we went back to Switzerland and took 44 of your Swiss aircraft. Brought them back into the United States and then modified them to play the adversary role. And so the jets that I actually flew in the active duty squadron, the Top Gun adversary squadron, were former Swiss aircraft. So a fun connection. And of course, we always laugh because Switzerland is so nice and takes care of their equipment so well that we traded in an old Navy fighter jet and got a new Swiss fighter jet, and it smelled like a new car, and everything worked, and it was wonderful. So thank you for taking care of those jets.
Absolutely. I mean, I just thought about it yesterday when I was driving back from Geneva, and I was going past a column of Swiss Army G-Class Mercedeses, and literally, like, you drive past these vehicles and they look better than showroom condition. I mean, there's not a speck of dust on these cars. And I do wonder sometimes how they actually do that. I mean, you know, there's even like, you know, they even have like tire polish on, which is like that sort of extent. I mean, I guess it's something to do with more practice than actually using them in anger. That's probably one component. But yeah, the maintenance is pretty flawless, I have to say.
Well, I think it dovetails into your culture, right? And why Swiss watches are so renowned for precision and everything else is your country and your culture is just to take care of things and to keep them at the highest level with maintenance and condition and everything else. And so something to be very proud of for sure as a country. And we were the benefactors here in the United States to receive some of your older aircraft that play a very, very critical role for us in the United States.
Yeah, so thank you. Definitely, I mean, in the beginning, it's United States who developed the aircraft successfully, and it's the Swiss who developed the watches successfully. So there is an exchange program going on. So when you're flying TAC Air, you can benefit from the precision reliability of an IWC Top Gun watch. On the other hand, the Swiss Air Force very grateful to benefit from all those amazing technological developments over the last 50 years or so. It's been quite some time. And I often talk about that, but for me, that was really my entire sort of childhood a dream of flying was really influenced by those aircraft, you know, especially the F-5 and later the F-18, because we had a place, a holiday place very close to the Swiss air base of Payerne, where the F-18 were first introduced and they built the first simulator and so on. And used to be able to drive right up to the fence where basically on the barrier they had a country road that went right across the runway. And when they had aircraft actually taxiing and taking off, they just closed the barrier, but you're literally like 8-10 meters away from the aircraft taking off when you're waiting in your car. And that used to always be the highlight of my autumn break holidays when they were doing like heavy flying in Payerne, is to go up and just, you know, that the serial experience of actually hearing the twin engines firing up of the F/A-18 taking off, that you know, that rawness of it, and the you know, it's just fully emotional. I think that's sort of what triggered that fascination in me quite a bit. How did it start for you? And tell us a little bit about your story and how you first got interested in this idea of one day being a jet pilot.
Well, I will, and just to dovetail a little bit on your story, even as an old fighter pilot right now, today, I still have those same emotions when I'm next to a jet taking off. So it's a joke that my wife will say is that if a plane flies overhead, there's zero chance that I will not look up and see what it is and try to analyze what's going on. So if you're passionate about aviation, it's with you for life. So sorry, Chris, you're gonna have that for the rest of your life.
Yeah, I know.
That passion. So for me, I was fortunate to really in just a lucky situation to be born into a family of aviation. My father, who's, oh, by the way, is going to turn 100 years old in 2 months.
Wow.
In
a month. That's
and a half,
amazing.
So knock on wood. Yeah. He flew and started flying in World War II. He joined the Navy, in World War II and started flying, Hellcats and Bearcats, and then went on to, Korea and even in Vietnam and flew, 50 different fighters and helicopters in the Navy. And so when I was growing up, my older brother as well joined Naval Aviation and started flying fighters as well. And so these guys I idolized. My dad is my hero, the most important human in the world to me, as a man, as a father, as a fighter pilot, as an officer, all the above. And then again, I really respect and idolize my brother as well. And so, I would say if there was a first, like a moment, we have a summer place like your summer place you were talking about, but, this is in Montana on Flathead Lake, a big, beautiful lake. And we're out on this island and my brother, took his jet and came zipping by and kind of low altitude, did a bunch of maneuvers, all of which, looking back at what I know now, were illegal and were shouldn't have been done in that area for sure. But nonetheless, those maneuvers and that seeing my brother doing that and the excitement that instilled in me, that was, if you will, the hook that was set. And at that point, I just thought, all right, I'm doing this, or at least I'm going to try. And my dad was always one of those guys who emphasized, you know, you have to try to chase your dreams. Even if you maybe don't achieve everything that you want, at least go after them with as much energy and passion as you can, because then when you get older, you'll never regret not going down a path, or at least trying to go down a path. And so I love that guidance, if you will. For me, it worked out where I was able to actually achieve the dream, but I can feel, and I've met many, many, many men that and women, but especially men that come up to me and say, man, I wish I would have done that. I always wanted to do that. I wish I would have done that. And so the guidance that I give my son now is the same thing. It's just, you know, chase your dreams, go after it 100%. And then whatever happens is going to happen, but at least you'll never look back and regret that you didn't try something. So that's how it all kind of started with me. Saw my brother and my dad, and then I just said, okay, that's it. And then I kind of jumped in with 2 feet after college, and then just very extremely fortunate that things just happened to go my way.
Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about Top Gun, because, I mean, as we're speaking, you up in Fallon, Nevada, the home of Top Gun, and I think this is always something where we have to explain a little bit and debunk some myths as well, because to me as well, in the beginning of the journey, many, many years ago, of having seen the movie, but then obviously coming in contact with the real Top Gun, there is some explaining that needs to be done. So Top Gun, of course, as you will explain to us in a minute, I think it's a nickname, right? At the end of the day, for the Strike Fighter Tactics Instructor Program, but it's not even, is that even an official name? It is, in a sense. Huh?
Well, I guess it's evolved into official name, but yeah, the main name, the Navy Fighter Weapons School is the course, if you will, or the actual command and squadron. So if you see like a document, that's what it would say, Navy Fighter Weapons School. Underneath, now we have what's called Nautica, Naval Air Warfare Development Center. The umbrella that it kind of looks under or is under. And then Top Gun is kind of more a word that evolved because we use that kind of terminology in the military. For example, aircraft carriers, we land on an aircraft carrier, as you were mentioning earlier, with a tail hook. And so we have a category actually called Top Hook, which we always try to compete with each other. Not necessarily, well, I guess the concept of competition is really good because it keeps everybody honed and performing at the best possible ability that they can. And so we like to compete with each other as a culture internally to develop everybody, to raise the bar on everybody's capabilities. And so I think that that's probably where the original genesis came from, was we would always have competitions. Even in my dad's era, I have his diary where he's, you know, competing and on air to air gunnery and air to ground stuff with his squadron mates, and who's the top bomber and who's the top gunner and who's the top strafer. And so I'm sure that that's kind of where it originally evolved from, but that's what everybody calls it now. And once the movie came out, of course, now the word Top Gun has it's transcended to a whole nother thing. IWC can be the Top Gun of watches. It's actually a word that's used to describe stuff all around.
Yeah. So we've got to establish one thing, Jim, because I think we've been arguing over this for years and years and years, but the real actual Top Gun, as you would spell it within the naval aviation community, is it one word or two words?
One word, all capitals.
Yeah, there we go. At least we got that one right.
Yeah.
That's it now. Definitive. One word, all caps.
But now, one word, all caps. It's interesting because the movie, so the real name, the official name is Navy Fighter Weapons School. And if you look at our patch, where you of course, you know, our patch, it says on the patch, United States Navy Fighter Weapons School. It doesn't say the word Top Gun. And so what Paramount and those guys did with the first movie, they said, well, we can't call the movie United States Navy Fighter Weapons School. We want to call it Top Gun. And then so they created a logo, if you will, a Paramount type logo that really the world probably, not probably, 100% recognizes that logo and that brand more than it does the real one. And I believe in that logo, it's two words, top being one word, gun being another word, type of thing. So that's probably where the genesis of the confusion came from.
I did a ton of research on that back in 2012 when I first got into the, you know, working on the first Top Gun launch at IWC that I was involved in. And I think the earliest inkling I got that this is what it was was actually graduation beer, you know, steins or mugs or whatever you want to call them, that were handed out as part of the Top Gun graduation ceremony. And I think there was an image of a certificate somewhere, whether that was an official certificate or not sure, but that really That's where I first saw that all caps Top Gun one word appearing. And as you rightly say, it doesn't say it on the patch. Therefore, you have to kind of look at the collateral to figure out exactly what it is. And then I think for me, the next very good indication was actually during my first ever visit to Fallon. Of course, just outside the base next to the subway is a gift shop. And you can clearly refer to what it says on the coffee mugs and what it says on the key rings. And I think now it's settled. So that's good for everybody as a heads up. So the movie is Top Gun, two words, not all caps. And the actual Top Gun is all caps and one word. That's sorted. Brilliant. We got somewhere. So tell us a little bit, give us a little bit of an overview. What is this and how does it relate to the day-to-day work of a fighter pilot? Because we understand you run through Navy basic flying program, you then probably graduate, you get into a fleet role, be that a squadron or another role, and then of course then Top Gun comes. So what is it, what does it teach, how does it happen, how do you get there?
So we just Top Gun Navy Fire Weapons School just finished its 50th year. As you know, IWC participated in that, and so it's been around for 50 years and it's evolved, as you can imagine, over time. The genesis of it was that in Vietnam, we being the United States, in air-to-air battles, were losing one aircraft for every aircraft we were victorious over. And so the United States said, that's not an acceptable ratio. We have to improve the air-to-air dogfighting capabilities. And so they established this school, Navy Fighter Weapons School at Miramar. And that was really the evolution. It was really a few guys that were tasked to it, some younger guys. And they just concentrated on how can we improve this one specific skill set because we're losing too many people. And so that was kind of the evolution or the beginning of it, the genesis of it. And then it's evolved, as you can imagine, over the years. As naval aviation has evolved, as the whole world has evolved. And now what happens is that each fighter squadron, so if you're flying Super Hornets on an aircraft carrier in a fighter squadron, the commanding officer will pick an individual about every third year or so. These are all generalities. And then that individual, or if you're a two-seat squadron, if you fly the F-18 that has both a fighter pilot and a WISO, a weapons system operator in the back, you'll send a crew. So about once every third year or so, a squadron will be able to send a crew, one or two guys, to fighter weapons school. And that person or that crew will go, and really it's like doing a 3-month plus doctorate course to get your PhD in the latest and greatest. And when I say latest and greatest, I mean all sides of what's happening in naval aviation. So you have an academic aspect of it where you're studying your weapon systems and the potential adversary that you might see's weapon systems. And then you fly air to ground stuff, you fly air to air stuff, and you essentially, you get this doctorate, if you will, on dogfighting and being the best of the best and the best that you can be at that point with the latest and greatest intelligence and information on everything, our systems, everybody else's systems. So when you walk out of that's Top Gun. That's what you do. So you come here for a few months and you go through this very, very difficult, challenging, but extremely rewarding course. And when you graduate out of that, you're the best you'll ever be. And your number one goal or your number one assignment, if you will, is to go back to your squadron or go back to the fleet and then proliferate that information out to your squadron mates or your, the weapons schools. Mm. And so, it's kind of like we say we teach the teachers. So yep. The Top Gun concept is grab a few people, teach them to then have them go out and teach the fleet. And yeah. so that's the way that we kind of stay on the tip of the spear as far as tactics and techniques and procedures and intelligence and all the above. That's how we proliferate like what we want to do as a country.
That means basically that in a regular fleet squadron, every 3 years or so, you would have a new Top Gun graduate coming into your squadron, having all the latest information, latest tactics, training guidelines, philosophy, and so on, to really keep the entire squadron up to date with that tactical side of things. Is that right?
Yes, and you know, in generalities, there's always slight little differences, and there's some other weapon school stuff, et cetera, that happens, but. In general, that's the mindset, and we talked about the Navy Fighter Weapons School patch or our logo. You don't get a trophy when you finish going to Top Gun, but you do get a patch, and the patch it signifies a lot. So that patch goes on your shoulder, on your flight suit, on your flight jacket, and that designates you. It's kind of like having a biography or a CV on your uniform, where you walk into the bar or the club or a ready room or a squadron, and they see a Top Gun patch on your shoulder, they know exactly what you are and who you are and where you've been and what you've done.
Mm. Or they're going to a stag do or a fancy dress party, which could also...
Yes, exactly.
and then, of course, as naval aviators are going back to their fleet squadrons, they would obviously wear the squadron patch and the name patch that is in the squadron colors and design that somehow go with a t-shirt, right?
So, yes, typically a normal flight suit or jacket, you would have your name tag. So it would say Jim DiMatteo. Often it'll say Guido, which is my call sign. And what kind of wings you have, that's on your left chest, whether you're a pilot or a naval flight officer, et cetera. And then you'll have a squadron patch designated which exact squadron. And that's usually on your right chest. And then on your shoulders is where you could put like the, on your right shoulder, you could put your Top Gun patch, if you will. On your left, a lot are now American flags. This is kind of what's kind of changed and evolved over the years. Unless you have some other designation that you want to do. But then when it goes, that's like a flight suit. And then when it goes to a flight jacket,
it gets a bit wild.
It gets a little bit wild, and there's some leeway, and some guys come in and try to change things as far as leadership, and then there's pushback, and the younger guys, and historically, and legacy, and there's always an argument about what flight jackets should look like. So it's again like your CV.
Yeah, exactly. But it's like you see, that's absolutely right. But from a civilian perspective, then, it's rather unlikely you'll be seeing a flight suit that is covered in different patches and mission patches, like from the bottom of the sleeve all the way up and every other visible surface. Not on a flight suit. That does happen occasionally on a jacket. And there's also this wonderful tradition of overlaying patches with different accomplishment degrees, sort of half overlaid, sewn one on top of the other. I've seen that quite a bit as well.
Yeah, when we typically, like if we talk about top hook, for example, that's the top landing grades, and we'll have what's called top 10. So we have they have 70 pilots on the aircraft carrier, and we go out for a month. That will be called a line period, and we'll rank the pilots from 1 to 70. And the top 10 pilot in their landings, and the top 10 pilots will be part of the top hook or top 10. And so that's a patch, and guys will put that on their jacket. Again, that's a CV, right? That's like an award. Mm-hmm. And if you get multiple ones, instead of putting it all over your jacket, you just kind of layer it, and you'll see, oh, that guy's got, four top hook patches, but they're kind of right on top of each other. So it doesn't take up as much space.
Which looks very cool, by the way. So we copied that for the Silver Spitfire mission that we did in 2019. By then overlaying the Silver Spitfire mission accomplished patch over the actual Silver Spitfire original patch. So there you go. That's the golden one goes on top of the silver one. So that's our little... You were our inspiration for that one.
Awesome.
Now, that's fascinating stuff. And what I want to get at a little bit is to understand a little bit the mindset. You know, we know, I mean, and you've hinted at that. Obviously, it's the elite of the elite. It's the top 1% or so of naval aviators actually going through the Top Gun program. And you hinted at this competitive mindset of it all being about a competition. Now, of course, air-to-air is probably not the standard reality out there in the world today. But how has this evolved over time, and why exactly is it so important to have this constant competitive mindset, and why is this so much part of the culture of Top Gun?
Well, I would say it's not only the culture of Top Gun, it's of fighter aviation. I would imagine internationally, but I know definitely in the Navy what I know the best, but also in the Air Force is, you get, I believe, and again, we have the benefit of 100 years of aviation, tactical aviation in behind us. And so we're really standing on the shoulders of the giants that created all these programs before us. And it has evolved into a situation where over time, I'm sure historically, they just found that if you keep a very competitive nature in your unit with each other from a friendly perspective, it and pressure to be the best amongst your peers, then you're going to perform and try your hardest to be the best that you can, because you're not only do you want the recognition of being the top guy, but you don't want the recognition of being the bottom guy. And so there's, you know, from a cultural perspective, there is your work ethic, your preparation, your determination to do better all increases from everybody from the bottom up, because nobody wants to be at the bottom. And especially if people know you're at the bottom. And we have, again, I refer to the landings on the carriers. And I say this because it's the most dangerous thing we do. And so there's a lot of emphasis of how do we maintain the absolute best skill set that we can and never let our guard down when we're landing on aircraft carriers, because lots and lots of historical mishaps have occurred. And so when you walk into a ready room, and we all do it, you glance at that board and you can tell right away who's the top, and more importantly, right away, who's struggling at the bottom. And so some people in a company might say, like a civilian company might say, that's brutal. That's horrible. You're embarrassing the poor person who's struggling. And maybe the answer is yes, but, what we've discovered over time is, because we're trying to raise the bar, not at the top, yes, at the top, but more importantly, we're trying to raise the bar of the bottom, right? Mm-hmm. We want everybody to be at a certain level or above. And so competitiveness within each other, and then the openly acknowledging who is at the top and who's maybe struggling, then there's that extra pressure. And it's kind of brutal, but if that extra pressure results in you doing better, that's great. But if that extra pressure results in you continually do poorly, or maybe even doing worse because you put too much pressure on yourself, well, that is going to result in you getting asked to do something else. And again, because it's life, it's concerning life and danger and risk, you're not failing in life. It's just you're not a carrier fighter pilot. You got to do something else. And you can go be an airline guy. You can be a helicopter pilot. You can go be a cargo guy. You can chase whatever other dream you want to do, but we don't want you to die doing this. And so that's where that competitiveness comes from.
Definitely not. And we're also looking after quite a bit of taxpayers' money, which is also a, a factor in the whole thing for sure. But let's talk about that a minute, because of course, one of the, as you pointed out, one of the absolute unique characteristics of the job is that in all weather conditions, day and night, you are trying to land a heavy, fast, fuel and weapons laden fighter jet on a boat, basically, which is somewhat not the most logical thing to do. And of course, there is that takeoff bit where you could argue, okay, that's a little bit more straightforward, get shot off the boat and full speed and off we go. I'm sure it's more complicated than that, but it sounds a bit more straightforward. But talk us a little bit through what actually happens when you try to land one of those fast and heavy jets on a relatively short flight deck. I mean, just for our metric friends, an aircraft carrier, what is about 320 meters long or something thereabouts, and obviously the actual runway part of it is even shorter because you're landing at an angle. But talk us through what actually goes into this process of bringing one of these jets down on the deck of a boat.
So how do we do that without killing people is training, and making sure that, again, we go have the bottom-up approach, that you have to have a certain capability. Even with that said, there's lots of situations that occur, especially in really bad weather, really black nights, or, you know, throw in a engine failure or something like that, some mechanical issue that you have with the plane or something's not working, and it can get extremely difficult extremely quickly. So coming back and landing in the daytime, you tend to, initially, of course, it's extremely difficult, but you tend to get used to it in the daytime. It gets very fun and competitive, and you try to be the best, right? We're all competing with each other. So you want to be top hook. So everybody comes in and breaks left, turns around, comes around, gear flaps down, coming around, land visually.
That makes it sound very simple, but let's talk about that step by step. So you're on sort of a glide approach path. At that point, I can only imagine, like, I'm just going to describe this sort of in my mental civilian mind, you know, the carrier is probably looking very, very small from where you are up there in the jet. And then what do you use to actually guide you in, and what happens? There's like a light, like a meatball type thing. There's other pilots on the ground that you're on the radio to, and just talk us through it a little bit, step by step.
Okay. So the daytime's different than the nighttime. And when I say nighttime, the nighttime approach is like an airliner. You know, you're coming straight in from many miles away, and you put your gear down and your flaps down, and you're just a straight in approach, just like you and I land on airliners. That would be kind of what we call like our nighttime approach. In the daytime, we come at 300-500 miles an hour overhead the ship at altitude, like at 800 feet overhead on top of the ship. And as soon as we hit where the ship is, we brake left, we turn a hard turn to the left, we reduce our throttles, we slow down, we pop our speed brakes out, we get to what, just a beam the ship going the other direction, we put our gear down and flaps down, and then we slow down, and then we turn and we land. And the only straightaway is about 17 seconds. That's what you're kind of targeting. And as you come around visually in that scenario, we have target altitudes and airspeeds the whole way around the pattern that you're trying to target, so that when you roll into what we call the groove, that's that final 17 seconds, when you roll into the groove, you're at the altitude you're supposed to be at, you're at the airspeed you're supposed to be at, and you're lined up where you're supposed to be lined up. And then you fly what you referenced it. We call it a meatball because it's a lighting system that's on the left side of the carrier that tells us if we're above glide slope, below glide slope, or on glide slope. And so we look at that visually to tell us where we are and should we climb or should we descend a little bit. Now, all this is happening extremely quickly. In fact, the time I was just talking, we would have already landed. And so
a few times.
we have to process that very quickly and react to it. there are, we say three things: meatball, lineup, angle of attack. So meatball tells you your glide slope. Are you above or below? Lineup, are you right where you're supposed to be? And oh, by the way, lineup is extremely difficult because it's moving when it's tiny.
And wind, and second, it's moving and it's small.
Moving and it's small. And it's even what we call in the ocean, you got the waves, right? But you also have the heave of the ocean. So the whole carrier, not just the back end will come up, but the whole carrier will raise and lower. So imagine the airliner trying to land on a runway where the runway is literally just moving all over the place. So you have to kind of adjust for that. And then airspeed, what we call angle of attack, because we have a tail hook, you really, if you're looking at the meatball and you see yourself on the altitude, but you're super fast, that means the hook to eye, it means the geometry is not quite right. You have to make an assumption, and the assumption is that you're on the airspeed that you're supposed to be on, because that will give you the right visual. So you have to, all these things are all happening, and you have to kind of get them all to happen together and work right, and then come down. And as soon as you land on an aircraft carrier, we go to full speed, full throttle. And the reason why is the landing area is what we call an angled deck. It doesn't go straight to the front of the ship. It angles a little bit. And the whole reason is that because it's so difficult, sometimes you miss, which we call bolter. And if you miss the wires, or even you did everything perfect and your hook just happened to skip over the wires, if you miss, then you have to go around. And so as soon as we land, we go to full power. And if the wire catches you, you're going to know right away. And it's a tragic, not tragic, it's a fantastic
dramatic
feeling,
yeah.
But it's dramatic, because you're going from 200 miles an hour to zero in a second. So it's kind of what we call a controlled crash. So we will go out, and if you miss the wire, then you have the power set up so your engines are spooled up so you can take off and try again. At nighttime, the last 17 seconds is the same, but setting up for it, we don't come overhead the ship and turn. We land like an airliner.
You come straight.
So we come straight at it. And we use much more instrumentation versus visual.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's the bit in the middle as well that you just sort of, went over quite casually, is the fact that you're extending a metal hook from the back of your aircraft, which got a hook bit on the end, which is a couple of inches big, or feels tiny anyway when you look at it. And you're trying to hit a series of wires that are actually stretched across the flight deck precisely with the back end of your aircraft and that particular hook to actually catch on, and that, as you described it, either then arrests you in a second from 200 miles to zero or not, in which case you better get a move on and start flying again. I mean, exactly. How big is that space of tolerance that you have from the earliest point where you can actually touch the hook down on the flight deck to catch the first wire, which you're not supposed to do, I guess, to the last opportunity? What's the kind of the space we've got?
From an altitude perspective, from a high or low, we're only talking a few feet that you can move that hook because...
Yeah, and a length distance between first wire and last wire?
And some have three, some have four, but basically it's probably a couple hundred feet in length, but that length is not really the challenge. The challenge is this hook tip is going sideways almost, right? So it's the length on the ship is a little bit more irrelevant. You only have maybe 5 feet of higher or lower where you're, if you're not there and at the right airspeed, you're not going to catch the wire.
Yeah. So, and we're talking here about, in metrics, sort of 19 meter long aircraft traveling at close to 200 miles an hour that you're trying to get onto a wire within sort of a 5 foot altitude kind of frame, which is, I mean, that is just astonishing.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like a window. Now, I will say, though, that and this is nothing against the younger guys, but these jets are getting, because of sophisticated technology, that whole thing about landing on an aircraft carrier that I just talked about is getting much less difficult. Now, there's still all the other parameters that you have to deal in there, and I'm not trying to say, oh, you know, back when I was young.
I'm back in the old days.
Yeah. Although it's true.
I did it with a pair of binoculars. There you go.
Yes. what they have realized, and this makes sense, of course, everybody can understand this, is that you're talking $100 million plus jets and lives at stake. And so it's worth developing technology that makes landing on a carrier as easy as possible. And when I talked to my dad in the early days, we were crashing lots and lots of planes trying to land on aircraft carriers. And fast forward, you know, 75 years, and the amount of planes we're crashing now today versus in the 40s is dramatically different. In a positive way. And it's
good,
the way it should be. Yeah.
Definitely. Now there's just a gentle voice reminding you to raise your sleep mask, to put your seat in an upright position, because you'll be landing.
Exactly.
In a minute. Yeah, that's good. It's all going in the right direction.
We do it. We love the British, you know, accents too. So I'm sure some British lady will tell us, you're a little low.
Exactly.
Get up a foot.
Yeah, a little low. Just raise your seat a little bit. There, yeah, yeah. Thank you. Can I take that tray from you?
Exactly.
Something like that. Brilliant. No, and of course as well, you mentioned that earlier, it's a perishable skill. So it's not that you do like some kind of takeoff and landing course and then it's like riding a bike and you've got it for life. So every time you train up towards a deployment on the carrier, you kind of have to try and learn that all over again, right?
Absolutely. And there are requirements for what we call currency. So on day and night at time. So as much as, you know, I say that it's a little easier now, the reality is the same, the internal pressure and requirement for the individuals are similar. And so currency is important to have. And then also kind of as you do it many, many times and have a lot of landings, it's like anything else, you start to learn what to anticipate and expect. In fighter jet aviation, we talk a lot about being what we call in front of the aircraft. So your mind is out in front of the aircraft. And when you move at incredibly high supersonic speeds, you know, at times you have to be thinking well ahead of the aircraft. Because if your brain is at the aircraft, that's dangerous because you're reacting to things and things are happening too quickly. If you're behind the aircraft, what that means is things are happening and then you're reacting to them. And that's very dangerous.
And interestingly, I think people like Lewis Hamilton, Formula One racing drivers in general, they will tell you exactly the same. You know, their focus is many, many meters ahead of the car, and they don't really deal with things that are, you know, in front of them. They deal with things way ahead, and that's also, I think, it's probably a function of speed, I guess, because you simply have to have this margin of reaction before it's just too late to correct your course. But let's cover quickly one thing I've noticed. Obviously, we've had the immense honor and pleasure over the years to work with many U.S. Navy and Marine Corps squadrons in the fleet, but also, of course, the Top Gun instructors in Fallon and so on. And then we can't fail to notice that there's a real fascination for mechanical watches in the community. And it's also very interesting to see what really makes those projects so fun for us as well is to see that the range of requirements really going from quite a sort of tactical, subdued designs to really quite sort of, you know, luxury focused, I'd say, almost storytelling focused, quite emotional designs. So tell us a little bit, what is this love affair between pilots and mechanical watches now today? As you said, there's a button for most things or a sensor for most things, but this idea of sort of all of the history and the ultimate backup instrument that seems to be still very much alive and kicking. So what's that all about?
I might have a special connection or bond with the mechanical watch, but I think it applies to all of us, is that as fighter pilots, is that we all have a huge appreciation for the history, the heritage, the legacy of, like I said, the warriors, that the heroes that came before us, and those are the giants that really had the tough times, but you know, we're the benefactor today of their hard work and incredible dedication and commitment and risk and all the stuff that, you know, and I'm not just talking the U.S., I'm talking internationally, you know, that whole generation really made things nicer for us today. So we have a huge respect for the history, the heritage, and the legacy of fighter pilots of the past. And the mechanical watch, to me, and I don't want to say this in a bad way, like it doesn't, like it's old, but it's a connection to that generation. Mm. It's a connection to that time in the world that the people who are our idols and our heroes, they were using those same watches, if you will. And in aviation, as you know, navigation is all about time, distance, heading, and timing, and being able to time things chronologically is a huge development over time. Again, right now you got just buttons you can push with, you know, GPS, blah blah blah. But still, kind of the genesis, the stuff that we're all proud of in the how our profession came about is symbolic in a mechanical watch, I believe. Now, it's even more important to somebody like me, because I remember, you know, the first watch I ever got was my dad's, and it was all scratched up. But he's my idol, and he gave me this watch that he used in the cockpit often, and it was symbolic of not just time, but also like of him and all that he went through to make my life better. We have that historic aspect of it. And then as fighter pilots, we're all kind of geeky in the, you know, in the mechanical world. Like we like engines and hydraulic pumps and all that kind of stuff. And so the concept of how a watch works, especially a mechanical watch, is just intriguing to us. That's like a Da Vinci thing, right? It's just like, that's cool. Indeed. And so this mechanical watch is a combo of all that. It's what we're naturally attracted to. It has the history and heritage of our occupation. It is symbolic of our iconic heroes. And so to me, all of that is combined, which, and when you look at it, it has all those emotions, plus it just looks really cool. And because of that, over time, it's just developed that if you're a fighter pilot, you better have a cool looking watch. And that's absolutely where we are today.
So on that note, a little wrist check. What's Jim DiMatteo wearing today?
I've got my SFTI watch right now.
Very nice.
With the green strap, because I fly this afternoon. It's the one that I like to wear in the jet. And uniquely, my dad's watch was all scratched up. And you might remember this, some of the older people I know, my dad used to wear his watch. I never really understood this until I started flying fighters. He wore the watch with the face on the inside of his hand, right?
Yeah.
Not on the outside. And I never knew why, because none of my other friends, parents, dads did that. And then I realized it was because when he's flying, he's smacking around inside the cockpit and is scratching up the glass on the outside. Well, you guys now, IWC, I'm looking at my watch right now. There's not a scratch on it. If anything, though, I thought there was this little gray, and I thought, oh, darn it, I nicked my watch. And then I realized that it was paint from the jet.
Transfer marks, yeah. So I discovered today, actually, one of my colleagues up here in product management, he's now got a pencil that has two different grade rubber ends to it. And that works perfectly, getting the transfer marks of the ceramic cases. So he just did it on my perpetual calendar Mojave Desert this morning, and it's good as new. And literally, yes, every time you think you've nicked the watch, you've actually nicked whatever the watch has struck. So
<That's it.
laughs> sorry to the American taxpayer or Taka in that case.
A lot of damage I'm doing inside the cockpit.
It's come off the jet. Absolutely.
But my watch looks great.
No, I get that. This whole like watch upside down at the time, obviously the leg of the pilot would have been considerably softer and kinder to the watch face than any other surface in the cockpit. So that made sense. But luckily today, the sapphire crystal is not only pressure drop resistant, but also obviously virtually unscratchable, which is a good thing.
It's amazing. I don't know how you do it, and it looks wonderful.
Jim, finally, that I saw on your CV, and one thing we have to talk about, because I think it is such a core part of the whole Top Gun philosophy and idea. Because for me personally, and do correct me if I'm completely off the mark there, but I always think it's a little bit the attitude of work hard, play hard, right? It's all about, there's a little bit of, you know, competitive, adventure seeking, thrill seeking, overcoming challenges, all of these elements. And then we're back on the ground, or we're back on the boat. Our heart rate that you described so aptly has somewhat relaxed and calmed down again. And then, you know, there is this sort of play hard, party hard kind of element. And I'm intrigued and excited to read that you've been operating nightclubs for the last 25 years.
Yes. It's funny that you say that, because I love that statement, play hard, work hard type of thing, because to me that kind of summarizes life, right? Go after it and enjoy it. So be proud of what you're doing on the work side, and then enjoy life on the other side. And so owning businesses, juggling the fighter pilot world, where it's incredible professionalism and guys, these are thoroughbred horses that I don't have to whip any ponies at all in a leadership perspective. They are hard charging.
But in the bar, it's a different story.
Running in restaurants and bars, it's different. But the thing that I really enjoyed in the restaurant bar, one, from an entrepreneurial perspective, I've loved just owning my own places. And that was always has been a dream of mine. And so I really enjoy that aspect of it. And the leadership aspect, I really enjoy that as well. And then bringing joy to other people. So as much as I like in the restaurant, bar, and nightclub world, I come from an Italian family that, you know, every Sunday, my mom and dad, we had 20, 30, 40 people over. That's what we did. That's how I grew up, was my parents entertained. And so I love that aspect of entertaining other people and making them happy when they walk out the door. And it was a natural transition to, you know, restaurants, bars, and clubs. It's very enjoyable for me to have people come, enjoy themselves, have fun, forget about the challenges they have in their life for that period of time, and then walk out the door, you know, smiling and, you know, just happy to be alive. And so that was very rewarding from my perspective. So that's where the combination was.
And you can't have a good fighter related movie without a bar scene. So we got to make sure we shoot one of those in one of yours one day.
you know, it's part of the culture, and sometimes the stuff that we get a little bit in trouble about, because I think it evolved. Again, if you think back in the World War II generation, that type of stuff, and, you know, in the tactical air side of things, meaning like dogfighting, and there's a lot of stress and pressure. And I think this was a way for them to get away from that for a while, right? Not endorsing the alcohol side of it. That was just part of it. It was more of a let's go do something socially to just completely get our mind off of the craziness that we have today and the craziness we have to go back to tomorrow. And so there's this fun camaraderie, kind of like a, you know, sports team. That's what a squadron really is. Squadron is really like a sports team. and the ready room is very much like a locker room. The relationships you have with with your fellow squadron mates is very much like I've had with, you know, fellow teammates, you know, in sports. And when you work together as a team and achieve a ultimate goal, especially if it's really hard to get there, the bonds that you form with those people are everlasting. And so I'm fortunate enough to have played rugby on a national championship level, and I'm still today friends with my national championship team from 1985 and 1984 and 1983. And it's amazing. And my son actually just won, his rugby team just won a couple weeks ago. And I told him, I said, you know, you're going to have friends from this team 35 years from now because you shared this journey and this challenge together with them, and you formed a bond. And when I look at my squadron mates, the ones that I went through the hardest times with, you know, as far as like combat and challenges and deployments on carriers and stuff, they're still my closest friends today. And so that's really unique. And I just love that aspect of it. And the bar kind of plays into that whole thing.
What a beautiful note to end on. Jimmy, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Wishing you all the best for your time in Fallon. Hope you have a good rest of your week. Enjoying doing what you're doing in clear crystal blue skies under the Nevada sun. We're not jealous at all here. Not jealous at all. I'll go back to my desk and carry on doing the things that I do.
Well,
but I hope that we can come out again very, very soon. Thank you so much for being on the IWC team, Jim, as well. It's an absolute pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
Thank you to all our listeners. Thank you for tuning into the podcast. And I speak to you all next time. And you, Jim, take care and speak to you very soon. All the best. Bye for now.
All right. Thank you very much. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. This is the Partners in Time podcast. Make sure you subscribe to never miss an episode. If you want to find out more, visit IWC.com. And you can, of course, follow us on Instagram. It's at IWC Watches. My Instagram is at Chris Granger Hare. Make sure you tune in. Speak to you soon.